is by making these impactful films, making this art, so it can inspire other individuals to go out and better their community. And I think if you look at musicians, when they rap on certain topics or they sing on certain topics, those it makes people want to go out and do something.
Right.
So it's almost like I was inspired by music to create films. So now I want to create films to inspire my community, so my community can get up and realize like education, creativity, good health, right, all that is basically how to live.
Yeah. And what's your personal website?
Tevin, T-E-V-I-N, J, Tavares, T-A-V-A-R-E-S.com.
Great. And so again, Combined Culture Radio is going to be debuting on KBOO next Wednesday, August 16th at 7 p.m. So it will be replacing Hard Knock Radio every Wednesdays. And thank you, Tevin, so much for being with us. And he will be back next week at 7 p.m. So stay tuned, folks. Thank you all for tuning in to News from the Boo. And Mike Crenshaw will be your host next week. Have a great week, everyone. Great evening.
The time is 6 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Right to Survive Radio.
I'm gonna listen to this shit. People don't like hearing my advice, but it's the truth. It's like, what is the point? You know, you put, I don't know how much studio time is because I get free studio too. But my ass has to pay for studio time, a DJ to host my mixtape, put it out on the platform. If I'm gonna promote it, you waste so much money. And videos, why not you? But you have to promote like a motherfucker. So the amount of money you have spent for a 16 song, 14 song EP, you can spend 3 songs and actually push those, get a lot of plays. This dude's dope. Another single, man. Oh shit, this dude is dope. Another single. Yo, this.
You're listening to Right to Survive Radio on KBOO 90.7. in Portland. I'm Ibrahim Mubarak of Right to Survive. On this show, we go to Ground Zero, Portland, Oregon, and report news and stories that corporate media don't cover. We'll bring the uncut reality from the perspective of the unhoused community.
This is Lisa Faye with Right to Survive Radio. R2S Radio goes into the houseless community, making their voices heard, speaking to individuals on subjects that directly relate to their daily struggles.
Somebody help me.
That's work.
This is not healthy.
Oh, man.
I am not wealthy.
What I do.
Check. This is Ibrahim Mubarak and Right to Survive Radio, along with Lisa Faye. And today we have a very interesting show. We have the Portland Assembly with us. And today we have...
Hi, I'm Olivia Louise.
Jonathan Ogden.
Okay, Olivia Louise, can you tell us just what you do and explain what Portland Assembly is?
All right, well, so I've been working with Portland Assembly since about January or February. I got into it because I was really interested in the social movements which were kind of developing around the era of Trumpism. People were questioning what we could do to prevent a lot of the policies we'd expect to see rolling out under Trump. But I think what I was drawn to about Portland Assembly is that they started questioning how can we dissolve these social movements into local governance. I think that is a really big question that we need to be asking, because when we talk about local governance, we're always talking about people power. And I think people power is a strategy for a broader liberation. I think when people are empowered, they do the right thing.
So when you talk about people power and the people in power, there are people in power.
Fair enough.
What kind of people do we want in power?
I know you're joking, but it is also a good question. Right? I want the right people in power. I want the people as they are, not people who are spoiled by capital, people who are working for other interests, and who are kind of playing out this larger neoliberal agenda, which we see sweeping the cities. We see gentrifying people out of their long-held homes, and we see really reshaping urban centers around the world.
And I'm glad you said that you came up with that, because this is a houseless radio show, and we talk about houseless issues before people became houseless, after they became houseless, while they're houseless, and the things that keep them stagnated in that certain social status. So you mentioned something about gentrification and sweep. Do you believe gentrification causes houselessness?
I mean, immediately, yes, I would say, absolutely. I think gentrification is, now it's kind of nebulous because gentrification is the process of viewing land as a commodity and viewing people's lives, their labor, and just generally their lives as something which is exploitable. So I do see gentrification as moving people away from their networks of stability, their families, their sort of heritage and their homes. And when someone is dislocated like that, it's very easy for them to fall through the cracks, especially with a state that has very little to offer in terms of support when someone is in such a precarious position. So yes, absolutely.
Jonathan, would you like to jump in on this conversation?
Sure. I mean, I think Olivia has nailed it. It definitely has a lot to do with the possession of and wielding of capital, right? And so when we say the right people in power, to me, that's all the people, right? There's a historical phrase, you know, all power to the people, that makes the most sense to me. And that means that people need to have direct control over their means of making a livelihood for themselves, because otherwise there's an element of coercion that is possible due to the inherent type of asymmetry you get with people who have and people who don't. And also to Olivia's point about this whole operation of viewing land as a commodity, what Portland Assembly is about to me also is this reinstatement of the commons. In fact, if you look at the history of capitalism especially, there is a very distinct movement from this commons idea of land ownership to specifically basically forcing people in England in the 1700s through enclosures to join the labor forces in the cities through expropriation of the land, through state means, really, you know, violent means. And that's kind of been the history ever since. And that's the precursor to modern imperialism where we're sitting today. So they're all very interrelated, interconnected. The gentrification problem is a housing bubble across the world. You see investments in a lot of empty skyscrapers across all kinds of cities, especially China now with their boom in industry. So it's a very interconnected problem, and it has a lot to do with this idea of dispossession of land and, you know, basically ownership over something that is in fact the right of all the people in the world, right?
So can you tell me why, well, it's obvious from your passion why the two of you got involved in Portland Assembly. But could you tell me what other young, inspiring people like yourselves that want to join a group would be attracted to be part of Portland Assembly?
So the question is, like, who would be a good fit for us, sort of, or who might be drawn to this work?
Who would be drawn? Who would make a good fit?
I think anyone who has, well, anyone who really kind of wants to get out and talk to their neighbors would be a really good fit. A lot of our work brings us to that same question: is who are we living next to? What is neighborliness? But it's not all kind of necessarily fun or shallow like that. I think that's actually really a big question. It's a big issue. A lot of young folks these days tend to be drawn to these very, very big questions of how can we dissolve the state? But we don't end up asking these more simpler questions like who do we live next to and how can we work with them? So I think someone who is kind of perhaps seeing the contradiction there of focusing too much on the big picture and not enough on these more tangible things, someone like that would be a really good fit. And there's a lot of people out there asking those questions. So I've been really excited to meet people through Portland Assembly that way.
And Jonathan, you want to explain yourself and what you do and what organizations that you belong to or that you frequent with?
Sure. Mostly Portland Assembly. I'm fairly new to any type of activism in that way, but I've been politically interested for most of my life, and I feel that that's something that would be attracted to a lot of people with regard to Portland Assembly. It's a very diverse idea. It's effectively a populist idea at the ground level. It's about understanding how to relate with one another and allocate resources properly and understand everyone's needs from a perspective of humanity rather than capital. But as far as other organizations, I've only really been helping with a few projects here or there, but Voice Workers Center over on MLK, they have a whole lot of good things going on. If ever you need some day labor, please hit them up. Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition does a lot of great work, especially with all the orgs that are affiliated with them. Voice is a part of that. But that's mainly who I've been focusing on, just because a lot of the more pertinent issues of the era, you know what I mean? A lot of ice sweeps, a lot of things like that, a lot of displacement of people through this, this continued buy-up and land grabbing. So I just feel compelled to try to make a difference with respect to that, because in Portland particularly, I'm also involved with recently the Neighborhood Association, but I'm kind of a new joiner to that. I'm not necessarily so involved in the system, but stepping back and from what I've seen in the history of it, it's it was a populist movement in the 70s in Portland to basically rectify a lot of the asymmetric influence that, you know, bars, brothels, so on, businesses had on the government here, and a lot of the projects that were aimed at specifically people of colors, neighborhoods historically, you know, building freeways, things like that. So it was a populist movement that came from the resistance to that development. And I think there's a lot of potential there for it to be an actionable kind of democratic extension of the neighborhoods as it was supposed to be. And my experience has been that it's kind of difficult because of the lack of participation in a lot of cases. Not that many people have been paying attention to it, but if it were able to be developed, I think that that's a really great avenue for people to take a look at with regard to how to assess their local areas and their neighbors' needs. So that's really where I've been at. I've been in those three avenues pretty much.
Wow, those three avenues was a mouthful. I mean, we can do 12 shows off of what you just told us.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. But because you say you're not doing much, but in each one is that intersectionality that's connecting, which make your work even more spread it out, and you're doing more than what you really think you are doing. Just like you said, you're working with Voss. And we can do the shop and compare with immigration and houseless people, how they've been treated the same way that people of the Hispanic descent are not are living on the streets and not counted into the houseless community, because they don't come step forward, because they don't have to have a legal paper to say they citizens in their own country, you know. So I see that comparison. And And do you see, and how can you compare the houseless crisis with the immigration crisis here in this city?
Oh,
or state? Yeah.
I mean, that they're definitely interrelated. In the case of Voss, I mean, it's one of the most heartbreaking things is you have people sleeping outside of the center on the sidewalk for work in the morning, right? That's probably some of the most stark examples of the lack of basic needs being met. So I think that from that you can start to see this picture of bureaucracy and barrier to entry to programs being a weapon, effectively, right? It's become weaponized, and the people who have the most control over that definitely have attitudes that make it an agenda that's largely based in racial arguments. It's not necessarily they're gonna come out and say that they're racist, but they're going to go ahead and do things where, if you look at the statistics, it's overwhelming. I mean, something like 40-50% of the houseless population is black folks, and then there's still a large percentage that are people of color. So being 12-15% of the total American population, that's absurd.
Yes.
Olivia, you didn't mention, but I know you're involved with Street Books. And Street Books, correct me if I'm wrong, but they go into impoverished communities and houseless areas and offer books for people to read. Could you tell us a little bit more about what Street Books does, and what do you see on the street when you're having your interactions with people?
Yeah, well, first things first, we got a really amazing library, a really amazing collection of books. And every Monday, which is my shift, I'm really excited to go out there and see some of those books make it into people's hands. More formally, it's a bike-powered mobile library. But I think one of the most important ways that we interact with the community is that there's no fees, for instance, if you lose a book or if your book gets stolen or destroyed, which is another barrier for actually consuming literature, which is, at the library, for instance, I once lost a book and a fee was $50. Now, I don't want to say don't go to the library. I really love the library. But that adds a lot of stress for people. I think even when I'm out there trying to get books, people are like, I can't take that on right now. If it got destroyed, I think that would really kind of just mess my whole week up. I'm like, well, you know, there's no worries. But what I see is a big, big desire to read and interact and have, I think, a lot of conversations about just the deeper things, the more important things in life, big questions of meaning. I think some of my favorite interactions have been just talking with people about Nietzsche, handing out some of my favorite writers, Octavia Butler, seeing that make it into people's hands, and then when they, if they return it, you know, a few weeks later, getting to talk to them, like, how did that shape your week? I think that too raises another issue, which is the question of, I want to say dignity. A lot of the state solutions that aren't people-powered tend to ignore that question. Not exclusively, but, you know, I think it's been really nice to talk to people and have really, like, human interactions that way. It's made my weeks better, for sure.
Recently, the Right to Survive ambassadors went on an outreach walk into the Lentz neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sad for us to see that areas where houseless people are normally congregating or selling down for the night had been swept. Yeah. It was like a ghost town in the section of Lentz that we were in. How does that make you feel when you're doing your street outreach with street books and areas where you know you visited last week or the week before are people are just gone?
Well, we tend to set up at shelters because we do need that reliability. So we haven't been doing necessary outreach at encampments. I have seen encampments, though, and I've seen the stark contrast of when suddenly they go missing. And I always wonder about who it was that forced these people to move. And but with street books, we do tend to reliably set up because that regularity allows people to come back to us as a resource. It would be interesting to see street books sort of work with this sort of outreach, though. I would be very interested in a project like that.
So now that you and Jonathan have introduced yourself and let the listening audience know what you all do and what you are going to do or capable of doing or desire to do or doing. Mm-hmm. So when you out there writing and bringing books to the houseless community, that breaks the myth that we're not smart, that we're stupid and stuff, but we are educating ourselves the best way we can. And Jonathan, you're dealing with the people at Voss, and y'all both see houselessness. Do y'all take this information to Portland Assembly and y'all discuss this to see how you can narrow the amount of people that's living on the streets or try to better their conditions or situations or something? I mean, either one of y'all can tell you.
Well, I would say the Portland Assembly and broadly, not just the Assembly, but I think anyone with a municipalist politic believes that these democratic forums hold the solution. And I think the reason is just as you mentioned, which is that these democratic forums are often a place for these empathetic information to be mm-hmm. shared. It's a chance to have conversations with people as you look them in the eyes. Mm-hmm. And it's a chance to, I think, have respect while we're communicating often a contradiction. In some of these neighborhood associations, town halls that I've been going to and learning more about, I have had very hard conversations with people who I fundamentally disagree with mm-hmm. and who are coming often attacking the houseless, you know, in, with their ideas, with what they want to see. Some of these people are staunch supporters of sweeps. But I think at these places, when I can talk to them and tell them what I see, I do see them shift. I do see them hear me. I hear them, too. You know, I think that's what's hard and frustrating about democracy is that it is very messy. But I've talked to people, and at the end of the conversation, I'd get them to say stuff like, I do not, like, they're like, fundamentally, sweeps aren't a solution. Yeah. I'm like, well, you weren't saying that 5 minutes ago.
Yes. And Jonathan.
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. And I think you kind of highlighted that there is a mythos around this kind of thing, right? In America, there's always been this idea of the rugged individuals triumphing over the natural, obstructions to whatever your will is.
Yeah, the guy with the white, tall white hat on.
Yeah, you can bootstrap that never yourself. Fall off.
Yeah.
Get a bootstrap to the moon, right?
Yeah.
But so that I think is something now that people are starting to understand has, bore itself out as a fallacy. It's definitely not the case that your limitations mentally and physically and socially are all tied to material wealth and material provisions. Mm-hmm. Those things are real. People do much better in situations where they have a supporting community and a solid place to live. I mean, there's studies and studies and studies and just done by the government alone that prove that isolation is the thing that breaks people down the quickest. Mm-hmm. And so it's an expectation people have for some reason that everyone who's on the street is perfectly apt and able to take care of themselves the same as anybody else would, and it's their fault, and it's probably something they did, or they might deserve it. And even if that were the case, that's ignoring the real effects of the stigma, and it's ignoring the real effects of the slippery slope of being somebody in that position. And so I really do see that there's an advantage to this very low-level, neighborhood-based, there's no barrier to entry, it's about proximity to one another, forum for discussion of that kind of thing. And I definitely see a path forward with respect to ideas like, the Village Coalition coming out and getting these grants to do these kinds of things and trying to form a federation between those groups in order to have a mutual support network where the state's falling down because they're not able to keep up. They're not able to keep up with the capital changes because they are, in fact, relegated by it. They don't have control over it either. The market dictates what they do, right? So they can't control it either. And we're saying we can take back the control. We're saying we can take control to the popular level because we have all the things we need. This isn't a production problem. This capitalist issue, 30% of the food wasted, more empty homes than there are people homeless, that's insane. Like, that is obviously a broken system, and it's a distribution problem, and we can fix that.
Okay, great. We're going to hear a little music and change directions.
Now we're back again with the Portland Assembly, and if you're just joining us, we have Olivia and Jonathan here with us from the Portland Assembly, and they go and try to assemble Portland, basically, with the door, and help people at the low income level, and try to create, equal social status. And I think that's what we need, what everybody know, and help out people so it won't be people living on the streets, people without their children, people without universal health care, or people without free education. So as you was ending, Jonathan, you were saying something about the democracy on how people... It works if people use it right.
Yes. Yeah.
And can you explain some more of that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it fundamentally requires that you assume some principles, right? Mm-hmm. It's a lot of these rhetorical principles that come with the Enlightenment era of Western influence, and even the things that we're foundationally supposed to believe about the United States, right? Mm-hmm. By the people, for the people, so on and so forth. But what they don't talk about is the asymmetry that social setup actually brings when you add in this factor of wealth, and wealth that creates wealth. And what happens there is that wealth then becomes power and influence under a system where the government itself cannot kowtow to industry, or has to kowtow to industry. And that kind of sets this precedent for a question of who's making the decisions, right? Who actually decides things? And that is where I think the real power is taking that decision-making back to the popular level and understanding things from a truly humanist, you know, expanding on Fanon's definition and his critical notes on humanism, as it were, being a tool for a long time to say who's human or not. You need to expand that definition to include everybody and get everybody's input, but simultaneously recognize the historical misgivings. And you know, basically we need some reparations also. That has to be part of the plan. So that all needs to be hashed out by the people participating in the best ways through a democratic forum.
So what you're saying, that the people allow this forum to happen and the public is really responsible for houselessness, and we can change that. I know somewhere in the government not going in the direction that the forefathers saw it in, that the public, the people can change it into a direction that it'd be for all the people.
Absolutely, and I would question their motivations, you know, historically speaking. I'd like to think that were true, right? That they had these goals in mind, but I don't necessarily think so.
So then why do we have houseless people then, if these goals wasn't in mind to keep people from being that way, I believe.
Or do you mean the founding fathers?
Yes.
Oh, that's exactly right. If it were playing out the way that they had said it would that be the problem? I think that they may be mistaken themselves. I think that's part of the issue. And I think the way that we could walk it all the way back is to say that this needs to be something that's even older, right? So maybe something like the Greek Agora. That's kind of even beyond Greece. Like, they've done this all over the world beforehand.
Okay, Libby, you say you want to say something. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say my politics take me to focus on the founding fathers. A thing that someone actually in the Portland Assembly said, I actually don't know who said it, but it stuck with me for a while, which was, no one is coming to save us. That we are the ones that we've been waiting for. I think.
Okay, I like that.
But I think that's a really important focus. It pulls us away from this idea of representation, of representative democracy, and in many ways, which can sometimes be a substitute for democracy, right? Where we expect our elected leaders to encompass the totality of what our needs are, and we expect them to meet our needs. But as Jonathan was pointing out earlier, often our elected leaders are much more beholden to the market and to these business alliances, which have established a very stronghold of influence over our city's shape and development. So I think one thing that I always find very important to make a distinction of is, Where are we putting our power, and are we giving it to an elected leader who then could either disappear, be killed, or change their mind, or have a giant check suddenly appear in their mail, or are we focusing on building power for people? And that's where this populist sort of assembly it differentiates, because I think we haven't seen that in America.
Okay,
yet.
So and that's what Portland Assembly is doing, is trying to create the real power for the people, where no matter what social status you're in, you have a say-so and a voice, and you're at the table.
So we touched base a little bit on community forums that are being brought forth by activist groups in the community and building power from within our community, for forming alliances. You mentioned the Village Coalition. And there was a mention of a federation forum from that would be brought with community groups. What would that look like if you were envisioning the forum? And what type of outcomes would you like to see in a just society that would come from
self-determination? Definitely self-determination, but it's nice because there's actually a burgeoning worldwide movement to look to, right? So there's actually great accomplishments that have already been made, and what you can see what that might look like. And if we look to things like Barcelona and Comú, which is a very big neighborhood-based movement that started in 2014 and worked its way through most of Spain, is I think now the third largest party, something like that. But Ada Colau is the mayor now through that election that they had participated in for the first time. And actually, Chloe Udaly had went and spoke at their conference last year, and that's something that's worth noting. You know, now being the only director, maybe that's some type of influence that we can lean toward for an actual popular platform. But effectively, it would be about self-determination and people saying what they need and actually being able to get it.
Cool. We also wanted to talk a little bit about what's going on with neighborhood associations. Mm-hmm. We would like to talk about Montevilla, but before we get there, I would like to hear what is happening in like Laurelhurst and Mount Tabor and Mount Scott and Lentz and Overlook
and Piedmont
and Park Rose. That has to do with continuing sweeps on the houseless people and putting up legislation to or resolutions to go to the city, hindering houseless people from having any communication with children or being in vicinities of school zones or parks. Can you tell me a little bit about more what's going on in Portland that way?
I've been participating in my local neighborhood association in Montevilla. I can't speak for the board whatsoever, but as far as I've seen, with respect to these other neighborhoods, there's quite a strong opposition to having these camps, and there's concerns over public safety, of sanitation, legitimate concerns. The neighbors have real concerns that they experience in their daily lives. They don't necessarily get to see the whole breadth of the economic problem through that lens. They really look at it on a person-to-person, this person's in my yard, they're harassing me. It's a lot of fear-based reasoning, and that seems to be the case for most of the more affluent neighborhoods. In particular, Overlook and Laurelhurst, I know, have very strong sentiments against it and actually have a circulating, idea or principles that they want to have other neighborhood associations sign on to that they'd put out on their website. But their position, I think, is just it's penny wise, pound foolish, right? This is a structural problem. And I think that a lot of times you get a lot of resistance and reactionary answers because people have an immediate need. We need containment action too, right? We need to triage this. I totally understand why you don't want to deal with somebody 3 a.m. yelling their head off. Like, all that kind of stuff makes sense too. But if we had a reasonable solution and a place for these people to go, I think that would probably be the most humane situation. And we could deal with the real issue, which is likely underlying mental illness, probably from stress and strain and whatever other problems you've met on the streets. There's a lot of issues to meet on the streets. So I think they're kind of short-sighted in that way, and hopefully people will be coming around to structural, basically reconstructing some systems that will help people.
I see a little bit of an identity flux, where I think there had been a striking lack of interest or participation in some of these neighborhood associations, and where a lot of people had, it wasn't an effective democracy, it was a lot of people who had a lot of the same ideas, and they were able to use the neighborhood association as a tool, and some of them have used that as a tool to push houseless folk out of the neighborhood, and we see that now again happening. I think that's why it's really important for us to talk about democracy, though, and the need for the neighborhood associations to always be open, democratic forums for the people who belong to that area to come and process what they're going through as a sort of communal group.
To that point, I see a lot of potential with the structure of these neighborhood associations being more democratic, because at the moment, a lot of times they're limited boards, limited funds, volunteers. I know that ONI's been under a lot of stress because their audits were bad and they had a lot of internal problems. So maybe this can be something as a proposed solution to try to democratize the enterprise, right? Just talk to them and work with them and take some of that load off of the centralized agency.
And I think as we see people taking interest in their neighborhood, taking interest in their neighborhood politic, we do see a kind of more robust conversation coming across. I was really impressed with some of the conversations I had at the Montevilla Town Hall, and I would really like to see more of those come out, because I think that's where we actually were able to get to the next level of conversation. Where do we go?
Okay, we're going to finish this conversation about neighborhood association, because that's where interesting. Now,
we'll be right back.
Even lying here, will you take me home? Could you?
Yeah, absolutely. So, makes sense, right?
Yeah.
So here we are back again, and we were talking when we left before that small intermission. We were talking about neighborhood association, which is something dear to my heart, because when houseless people get housed again, they should weave back into the intricate part of society and make a difference and let people realize, you know, we shouldn't scorn or sweep or push people around or reject people because they without a house. They still human. I was there before. And we should join these neighborhood associations to educate people who, you know, who's looking through different color lenses and stuff. So let's continue about neighborhood association gathering together instead of pushing that problem on somebody else, which we all know people are not the problem. The problem is the problem. Mm-hmm. So in Montevilla, neighborhood wants to do something about that instead of sweeping someone's bad things on other people and come up with solutions. Have any other neighborhood association reached out and asked you on how, what y'all coming up with, what you're trying to do, how to help and instruct, and reaching out to different organizations like Right to Survive and Village Coalitions and places like that, things like that?
Oh, so, I mean, just to be perfectly clear, it's definitely still contentious in Montevilla. I know there are some board members who feel strongly in the opposition of that, and there are some board members who are in line with that, especially older board members who've had some tenure there. But it's still a relevant question regardless. People are talking about it now, which is a difference. So it's at least opened up that conversation to become a part of people's, you know, daily interaction, really. And that kind of harkens back to the initial movements, like we'd mentioned before. It really came from these populist movements that had people in their neighborhoods banding together and trying to come up with solutions. They effectively created a people's plan of Portland. That's why we actually have a lot of the amazing infrastructure we have. I mean, I know Tomacall Park downtown, that used to be a highway, and that turned into a park because of that movement. So there are certain things that can be done through that agency that definitely could provide some infrastructure structure these people and make a big difference.
Okay, what do you think about this? I think in a Laura Hurst neighborhood association, they don't want houseless people in the parks where children play or around schools anything.
Well, from what I understood, Laurel Hurst had been interested in developing some tools to push houseless folk out of the park, and they either tried to pass a resolution, I'm not sure exactly, but I do know that apparently Ted Wheeler had said that this wouldn't be necessary. In many ways, he felt he already had all the tools he needed to accomplish what they had asked him to accomplish. I see that as a frustration. I see that as a lack of democratic participation to have a solution so one-sided. And I think that we would see a kind of more healthy and holistic answer if we were to actually harness the neighborhood associations for the democratic forums that they're designed to be. I think when, once again, to reemphasize a point I've sort of made a few times, but that when people are given the chance to have an actual empathetic person-to-person conversation, they do try to see the best in each other. And I think it's really important to go into these places where we see neighbors panicking and grasping at straws a bit, and to say that there are solutions that are working. There are ways that we can allow people to have dignity, to not be see their lives destroyed by sweeps. And I think the people who are pushing for these policies also need the chance to be given that information.
So here you have two different neighborhoods addressing two different issues. The Montevello don't want sweeps, they want a solution. Laura Hurst won't sweep and don't give a care about the address. I mean, so what neighborhood association will, you know, the city officials listen to? Or does it mean what they address is what they would take precedence?
Well, it sounds like right now the city doesn't want to listen to either.
City's probably tired of all of them. Is probably how it is. I think this is actually a question I think that it would have to be addressed outside of the city's decision-making process. They got a lot to handle already. In my opinion, what would be best is that you had a confederation of these neighborhood associations start to talk about it. And you mentioned Piedmont. I know that there's some people who have been trying to work with Overlook within that group who are interested in similar things. I think it's effectively that a lot of people who have those opinions are somewhat insulated from the realities of the kind of property issues that we're having, but it all stems back to that. It's all about this idea that we've somehow understood land as a commodity for purchase, and I just fundamentally disagree with that. It came from a very distinct event in history that was very violent, and it's been a very violent separation of one another ever since, and now we're finally reaching a point where we can probably return to a commons production system and understand what that means for everybody. And I think neighborhood associations are in the spirit of that.
So I think that these neighborhood associations should look at the Kenton Village and seeing what they're doing. I think they should talk to the Business Alliance that was around Right to Dream 2, how at first they didn't want it, but then they seen the crime rate go down, guess what, 0.08% or something like that. At least it went down. It wasn't more. So these projects are working. And these, in the meantime, solution is what we're needed, and it's less expensive. So why are people or neighborhood association, if they can come talk to the people, like Village Coalition or Right to Survive, and Portland Assembly, on how we think we should do these things, and instead of just being bashing people, I think this would be a better city and a more open sanctuary city, as they say.
So I think that the history of neighborhood associations and how they were formed is something that's still relevant today. Would either one of you like to tell us a little bit of how neighborhood associations did start and why they were formed?
Oh, sure. I've gotten to read it a lot. I don't know if you've read much. You can chime in whenever you like. My understanding is it really did come from a lot of the era prior to the annexation of the East Side in particular. Southeast Uplift is one of the oldest formations, from what I understand, 1968, I believe, it was formed. And it basically grew as a movement from the southeast portions of Portland up until North Portland as those plans for federal highways and things kind of came through. So it was really this bond that was formed over mutual displacement. And that again, it comes back to the land, and it comes over the provisions that people have in order to maintain their land and maintain their livelihoods. And I think that that progressed on and on and on until it became a formalized system. From my understanding, there's a lot of protesting, there's a lot of working with a corrupt government, quote unquote. But from the history, it looks like it was the case. There's a lot of untoward business influence, a lot of developer influence early on in the 70s, a lot of moneyed interests making the key decisions about infrastructure that affects everybody's lives. It affects what jobs are created in the area. It affects what class of people can afford to live there by proxy. And all of that spurred these people to form coalitions that kind of put a damper on that ability, and that's one way I think you can level the playing field, because it easily just goes off the rails and becomes very asymmetric.
Yeah, I think when I was studying somewhat of the history of the neighborhood assemblies, I couldn't help but think that we've been here before, and that we're having a lot of the same conversations today. People at the time who were it started with rioting, basically. It started with protests in the street, but then people took their analysis and they began to look at highway construction, and I think also the development of the cities at that point. I think something really good happens when people combine their social plights with looking at infrastructure, and I think also usually an ecological analysis. There was a big emphasis on trees, on saving the environment, and what highway development meant for the larger global environment. And something good happens when all three of these things intersect, because we begin talking about building something tangible. And those protest movements did build something tangible, something that exists today, and that we're here talking about how we can use them, how we can work with them, and how we can use them to continue this conversation.
So as we continue our conversations, what are some of the things that
neighbors are saying when they want to be inclusive with people that are marginalized, people that have lost their homes, tenants that are worried that one paycheck will keep them or a rent hike will put them out on the street as well. So what type of conversations are neighborhoods having?
It depends. I've attended my Grant Park board meetings, and recently I have moved, however, to Montevilla, and so I'm sort of learning about the neighborhood there. I don't know what each neighborhood association is doing necessarily to address accessibility. I think that's a really important conversation for us to be having. Are they accessible to the people in the area? I was recently a little disturbed to hear that Overlook is interested in sort of limiting eligibility to membership, and specifically making it so that you have to have a home address, because this would be basically a provision that intentionally excludes houseless folks. I think I would like to, I like to raise this analysis of neighborhood associations as democratic forums, because it's really important to the identity. It needs to be accessible for it to be functional.
I mean, what was that? Can you rephrase the question? Sorry. I got lost in that.
With people,
it was interesting, huh?
With people that are houseless and people worried about rent hikes going up or being a paycheck away from being on the streets themselves, what conversations are they having within their own neighborhoods to want to make sure that their stability is stated, secured there in the community?
I believe you kind of hit the underlying nail on the head with respect to people's fear-based reasoning on a lot of this. It's it has a lot to do with that provision of you know, their check coming in on time, and so really the conversations I've seen have been a lot of apprehension, a lot of, you know, I want to make sure I can keep my situation stable, like a lot of concerns about livability, and that makes sense. But I also think there needs to be this honest conversation that hasn't quite transpired yet about income disparity and about how much you actually need to survive, because in American culture, like I was saying, this rugged individualism imposes that you have to always be able to take care of yourself, and if you can't, you're somehow inferior by proxy, because, you know, divine right of wealth, if you're not wealthy, God doesn't like you, or something similar. Like that, that's kind of what drives it, it seems. So there's not really a frank conversation being had about how close a lot of people actually are to being houseless themselves. People talk about rent and all that, but the subtext there is that, oh, without this place I'm living, I will actually be joining these people. And that's probably a deep-seated fear that drives a lot of denial.
So, and in truth, I do think neighborhood associations need to talk more about accessibility, particularly to houseless as well as renters. Many renters don't feel like they necessarily belong to a neighborhood. And I think we need to talk about their inclusion.
Yeah, that was something that was on my mind. Is do neighborhood associations belong to people that own houses, or people that rent houses, or people that are sleeping on the sidewalk, or who should be in a neighborhood association or have a voting power? But we'll come back for that answer right after some more music.
Let's talk about the inherent.
There's nothing in this world I wouldn't do.
Jonathan and Olivia, you all want me to repeat the question? Or
please.
Do you want me to repeat? Oh, wow.
It was a long one.
Okay, and these neighborhood associations, the power to be the voice of the people that make the decision, is that just for the people that own a home, or people that's renting homes or apartments, or people that live in an area, whether they are houseless or not?
So that is somewhat the beauty of these neighborhood associations is that they all write their own bylaws, so they are able to be configured by the people as defined by the bylaws.
The beauty and the danger.
Oh, right. and so it does not exclude inherently anybody who lives within the neighborhood bounds. So it's effectively, in Montville at least, because that's my experience, if you read the bylaws, it states that the boundaries of the city are the boundaries of the neighborhood association. And you can have the board vote to make exceptions if you have business interests in the area, what have you. A lot of times it's the determination of the board, but having been involved for a minute, there's a lot of capacity issues with volunteer work, obviously, but just based off of populations, for the true spirit of these associations to really be carried out, there needs to be discussion about the numbers, because 11 people for a neighborhood of 16,000 is something I've mentioned to the neighbors online and talked about a bit, but that seems really unfair. That's less than 1 to 1,000 representation, and even that's bad. So that is something that I really would like to bring up to a lot of officials who may be involved, because even with other board members, we discuss having delegates from local organizations who are informed come talk to us. Joins in the area, maybe Right to Survive folks, PTU, groups like that have interest in this question of where do we live. And I think a delegate representation system is good. I think having people represent directly other groups of people is some way that we could probably get some throughput.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Olivia, before you answer, I just got one more question. So, from what you're saying, Jonathan, if I own a business in a neighborhood association, let's say Montevallo, since we own that one, okay?
Yeah.
And I live in Lake Oswego, I can make decision what happened in Montevallo?
Only if you're voted onto the board by the board members in that case.
Because I have a business there.
Yeah, it's at the discretion. So it's default is the local boundaries, but it's per the bylaws of that association. Mm-hmm. And in our case, if you had a business interest, you'd say, hey, I'm so-and-so, I want to join. I have a business here for a blank amount of years. Mm-hmm. One of the members is a pastor of the church, that kind of thing. You say, I have stake in here, I care about this, I want to be involved here. Mm-hmm. But the general membership is simply people who have registered their addresses and emails and stuff.
I'd like to point out that also it applies to nonprofits as well. So that many nonprofits don't realize, but they do have a stake in their neighborhood association, and they can send an ambassador or a delegate if needed.
So if a nonprofit is doing work, not have an office or nothing there, nothing physical, stable, but doing work within that environment, within that neighborhood, they can have somebody on the board.
I don't know. That would have to depend on the bylaws for sure.
Yeah, and the board vote. They get to vote on it from my perspective. Mm-hmm.
True.
Now, Right to Survive Ambassador Program is having an event on the 28th of August at 6 p.m. at Apano on 82nd Division. And we're going to be discussing many of the topics that we are discussing tonight. We want to have a panel of guests that are houseless and have neighbors from primarily Montevilla, Lentz, Mount Scott, and the surrounding communities come over and join us that night for open discussions about houselessness and how, as a part of your neighborhood, with houseless people in your neighborhood, how can you sit down and envision a place where everyone feels included, inclusive, what would be a just looking neighborhood. And one way Right to Survive Ambassadors plan on doing that is by having art supplies at the table, so people can sit down together and envision their neighborhood together that way.
That's cool. I like that.
We'll also have food and welcome everybody to come out. Again, that's the Right to Survive Ambassador Program. We'll be hosting the event at Apano on August 28th at 6 p.m. There'll be food. It's child-friendly. And we ask everyone to come out and bring their best ideas with them.
Now, for that small commercial break, and so what's next for Portland Assembly? What do you all have planned or on the agenda?
There's quite a few things, but really networking, mutual aid, that seems to be the thing right now. We're talking about who has what stuff, who needs it, how do you get it to them, and how do we set up more free resources in the neighborhoods. And I've been talking to a few people. Actually, the 501 that runs the Art House Cafe at the Milepost 5, they're interested in trying to work to maybe have an area where they had a cafe last summer. We were talking about how we had some free coffee donations. Maybe we could have a free cafe, at least some stuff, and try to just lower that barrier to entry to having public space, for one. But not only that, try to meet these resource needs and identify these areas where there's warming centers or cooling centers or just resources for people who might need them.
And Olivia, you have anything to add or?
My Neighborhood Action Council, which is the sort of smaller council formations we use, they're smaller, they're a little more mobile, and these action councils plug into the larger spokes council. But my Neighborhood Action Council is also working on a very similar information mapping, sort of trying to establish sort of a firm basis of resources when it comes to municipal politics. Where do you look? Where can you go? And I think especially, for instance, the basics of the history of these neighborhood associations. This is not largely known. People, when they want to get involved in their immediate neighborhood, often do find it inaccessible. And I know my Neighborhood Action Council has definitely focused on trying to make this information more available.
So are y'all going through neighborhood, passing out flyers or talking to the houseless community or door knocking, saying, hey, we want to dialogue, anything?
Different groups have definitely, I think most recently, responded to the heat wave. I know the Southeast Central Action Council did an amazing resource drive where they were getting ice water out to folks. And the same thing happened in the winter when there was the freeze in the Lentz neighborhood. The infrastructure body at that time established a resource drive as well. And so we do see these sort of short-term responses, but I think as we grow, we're broadening our capacity, and we're also getting to know each other and establishing long-term relationships. I hope we can continue to provide these sort of quick defense resources.
Are you seeing more the operation growing or your organization growing with both advocates, house people and unhoused people?
There's a bit of blowback because people see it as a push of an agenda, and I'd want to squash that outright because I would also say that formally it's not an organization, it's a movement, right? That's part of the difference.
Right.
I mean, I'm not trying to cash in on anything
with
this.
That's okay, the movement, that's right.
Okay. You do this because you actually care for a future, not because you're trying to make a buck. So it's it's a little bit different motivation than another org might have with a specific set of goals. This goal is actually to change the way we interact and the way that people have power.
Mm-hmm. So what's coming up next for Portland Assembly?
Oh, there is some good stuff, I think. There was just a spokes council recently. Some votes were passed. We're trying to use some more online forums for decision making, looking into that kind of thing. But I actually don't know what events are coming up. Oh, free store, Piedmont Neck. There is a free store in Piedmont Neck. If you go look up on the Portland Assembly site, you can probably see that. I don't know the date, I'm sorry.
I know, we didn't do our homework. I think we've been through a summer of introspection. You know, for sure, we're working on our internal communication, but we're definitely still front-facing. We're still looking forward to the future. And I do hope we can be rolling out some perhaps general assemblies in the near future, pulling people in and continuing this municipalist agenda.
And how can people get a hold of you or look at your website to see what you're doing or, you know, come join us, you know, all that rigmarole.
All that rigmarole.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, definitely come join us. We're portlandassembly.com, also on Facebook, Portland Assembly, and as well as Twitter. You can find on portlandassembly.com, there's a feature called the NAC map. That's the Neighborhood Action Council map. And you can use that to contact your nearest action council. And these would be the people that you would directly go to, ask about meetings, and see how you can plug in if they have projects that you're interested in.
So if you want to know what to do in your neighborhood about houseless community and don't want to kick them out, contact portlandassembly.com or righttosurvive.org for the Right to Survive Ambassador Program. And they both doing similar things with connecting the dots and stitching in communities together. We doing some great things. So thank you all for listening, and hope to see you and hear from you next month.
And it's important to remind everybody that tomorrow night's Right to Survive General Meeting will be canceled due to deep cleaning of Sisters of the Road. So we will see you all in 2 weeks, and listen to us next month, the second Wednesday of the month, here on KBOO. I'm your host, Lisa Pei.
And thank you to our guest.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Behind your couch, and it's knowing I'm not shackled by forgotten words and bonds and the ink stains that are dried upon some line that keeps you in the back roads by the rivers of my memory. It keeps you ever gentle on my mind. It's not clinging to the rocks and ivy planted on their columns now that bind me, or something that somebody said because they thought we fit together walking. It's just knowing that the world will not be cursing or forgiving when I walk along some railroad track and find that you're moving on the back roads by the rivers of my memory, and for hours you're just gentle on my mind. Though the wheat fields and the clotheslines and the junkyards and the highways come between us, and some other woman's crying to her mother 'cause she turned and I was gone,
I still might. Well, well, good evening. In the background, we hear Glenn Campbell, Gentle on My Mind from 1967. It's a tribute. He passed yesterday, I believe. And we just heard from Right to Survive Radio. And Hard Knock Radio is next. I have a couple of community announcements, checking in with the community calendar. So let's go to that, shall we? Thought you'd agree. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial and KBOO.FM on the web. Through cupped hands round the tin can, I pretend to hold you to my breast and find.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the first annual Pan-African Festival of Oregon on Saturday, August 12th at Pioneer Courthouse Square, Portland. The first Pan-African Festival features entertainment, African food and clothing, informational booths, panel discussions,